Hey guys, before we get into this episode, I want to welcome our new sponsor, MovementLectures.com. It is a great resource out there for strength and conditioning coaches, people in the fitness field, and fitness enthusiasts to get educated at their computer. Keeping up with the current changes in training and rehabilitation is nearly impossible, but downloadable audio lectures in your car, on your mobile device, or even your computer can help you keep up to date. Current, inexpensive, and recorded by the top experts in strength and conditioning and rehab, visit MovementLectures.com and use the coupon code FITCAST for a free $5 lecture. Hello and welcome to episode number 288 of the FitCast. I am Kevin Larrabee and I'm very happy to have back on the show Alan Aragon. Alan, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Kevin. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, man. So I've been talking on the internet and stuff about how that I'm like really trying to get some of my favorite guests from the last, whatever, 7 years back on the show. And you're a guest that I've loved having on, and the audience itself kind of exploded as soon as I announced that you were coming back on the show. So this should be a good one. Thank you for making the time. It's a huge pleasure, like I said.
Oh, that's awesome, man. I'm excited to get some good info out there and, you know, see if I can give the audience more than they expected. And yeah, we'll see. We'll see what kind of throwdowns and bro-downs we can do here.
Nice. All right, let's get it going. Just to start off the show, for people out there that don't know, you have this awesome service that you do called the Research Review. That is for people that really don't want to, you know, go through every single journal that comes out and go through the research and then having to actually go and digest it. And that's something that you're still going in, like you were just finishing up this week. So how's that been going?
That's going really well, man. It's my way of keeping abreast of the literature. It's my way of keeping current and helping other health professionals and fitness professionals and enthusiasts do the same thing. Just kind of keep people educated while staying on top of things myself. And it's been something that's been going real well. It's an all-consuming type of thing. It's my biggest ongoing project. And yeah, it's something that makes me really, really happy about doing. And it gets me excited about getting out of bed and I guess trying to make the fitness industry and the world smarter and more educated about stuff and kind of keeping them guarded from a lot of the BS that floats around the industry.
Yeah, we'll hit on a lot of that stuff. And it is interesting that so many people out there are just using, whether it's anecdotal evidence or just straight BS to say what they're doing is actually working. But we'll be hitting on that in a little bit. But we had a lot of people that were very concerned on Facebook and Twitter. And people just wanted to know, you know, do you even lift?
Yeah, that's an odd thing. That's a good question because there are no physique shots of me on the internet. There's no shirtless shots of me on the internet. There's no
promo shots.
Yeah, no promo shots with oil and me getting spritzed with distilled water and things like that, wearing booty shorts. But yeah, I do actually lift. So let's put that question to bed right now, so to speak. Yes, I do lift.
So are you doing like German volume training right now?
I'm doing a lot of CrossFit and a lot of P90X. I intersperse that with a bunch of Ripito stuff.
Mm, perfect. Just mix it up. Muscle confusion, right?
Yep. Got to keep them guessing.
Got to keep them guessing. All right, let's go into the questions from the audience. Thank you, everyone out there that submitted a ton of stuff. The first thing that I want to get started off with is something that is kind of blown up in terms of its popularity. You know, thanks to the Joe Rogan podcast, I guess is where it originated in terms of its popularity for the internet. Bulletproof coffee and. So what's up with the bulletproof coffee? For people that I guess don't know, people are putting like grass-fed butter into their black coffee to help, I guess, cleanse it. Again, immediately I kind of thought this was bullcrap. But what's your take on the whole bulletproof coffee thing?
Well, bulletproof coffee is something that's real popular because, number one, coffee is popular and caffeine is the most widely used drug in the world. And so, you combine the allure of coffee with the promise of burning fat, in quotes, and a particular product that's low in mold or mycotoxins or fungi derived pathogens, then you have a pretty good recipe to BS people into paying extra for a coffee product. And you also have a good, well, the other thing about adding fat to coffee, you add cream to coffee, it makes it good, right? I add whole milk to coffee to make it more palatable. And, not everybody, and this is including me, I'm not a black coffee person.
I was laughing, but muted because they're cutting down branches outside my house. So hopefully they just decided to start that like 10 minutes ago. Before we started recording, so hopefully that's not the end.
When I was leading up to that one, I wasn't sure whether I was going to drop that one or not, but I'm thinking, you know what?
It works.
I think the FitCast audience can handle that kind of joking around. But yeah, back to actual bulletproof coffee. The guy who promotes it, the guy who sells it, he says that his coffee is free of these mycotoxins that can have adverse health effects. And the biggest issue with that is that there really is no mycotoxin problem in the coffee supply in the developed world. And so he's essentially creating a problem that doesn't exist and fitting a product to a non-existent need, so to speak. And the whole idea of putting grass-fed butter in your coffee, yeah, that could be a taste thing for some people. But then he's also throwing MCT oil into the coffee. And at the end of the rainbow, you have a 400 to 600 calorie cup of coffee with all those calories coming from fat. And there's no way in hell that this recipe is inherently fat-burning. If anything, it's inherently fat storing. Mm-hmm. The only way something can be fat burning is if it increases your fecal output, and then you get less metabolizable energy than you actually ingested. But that's kind of a far-fetched scenario, and it's certainly not a pretty scenario. And the whole idea of consuming fat to burn more fat is just patently ridiculous. And the only way you are going to be burning more fat on a net basis over time is if you sustain some sort of a caloric deficit, whether it's by the end of the day or by the end of the week. It's not going to be by some sort of special fat-laden coffee product.
Man, that makes sense. I mean, I'd say, again, people like jump on these trends and just hold on to them and just ride them all the way out. But hopefully some people can listen to this and think about it a little bit more, see if it really makes sense. So one of the questions that I wanted to ask you, and it's kind of a trend with a couple of the last past interviews that I've been doing, the concept of staying consistent with your clients when it comes to following a nutrition program. Again, it seems to be that we have the ability to prescribe a plan that works and it's backed by research. Like, we know what to do in terms of calorie deficits and things like that. But then at the end of the day, we need these people to actually follow these programs. So I was wondering, how do you address this with clients that have trouble being consistent with the plan that you give them? Do you have any tips for helping them with their adherence?
Yes, I will answer that, but I forgot to mention about bulletproof coffee. And this is something that was tipped off to me from my friends and colleagues, Spencer and Casey Nadolski, the lean docs. They reported that some of their patients with wonky blood lipid profiles actually started the Bulletproof Coffee Regimen. And what it did was increase their LDLs as well as their apolipoprotein B particles. So their ApoB particles. So that's the atherogenic particle, or one of the atherogenic particles. And so this was concerning, that Bulletproof Coffee was actually screwing up their blood lipid profiles. So I wanted to throw that in there. It's not just something that is a load of bullshit that won't do what it claims to do, but it can also have adverse health consequences. So back to your question about how to get clients consistent with a plan, consistent with a diet. The key there is, in the first place, in the beginning, you have to make sure that the diet is based on their favorite foods. So there's really no magic set of foods, like, you know, the six magic foods or the four magic foods or the specific vegetables that are superior to all others, or specific fruits, specific meats. You really have to do an inventory of the client's favorite foods and base the diet on their favorite foods. So if it's going to be a weight loss diet, it's going to involve the reduction of total calories in. It's usually going to be a combination of that plus some increase in calories out. And the reduction of caloric intake cannot be so severe. And this is in most cases. There are some cases where severe caloric deficits are warranted for a particular specialized type of goal or event, or, you know, movie role, photo shoot, etc. That's coming up in short order. But for the most part, you want to keep the deficit to a degree that doesn't compromise adherence. And in combination with that, you want to make sure that they're consuming their favorite foods. So deficits that don't compromise adherence, or that minimally compromise adherence, are ones that are not drastic. I'm talking about a 10 to 20, 25-ish percent reduction in their intake, or rather reduction from maintenance levels. So that's what we're talking about there. Combine that with your favorite foods, and then you can increase or maximize consistency of sticking with the plan.
Perfect. Let's, on the same note, talking about sugar addiction, we had a couple of comments on Facebook of people that wanted to get your thoughts on that. So what are they?
Yeah, sugar addiction is a big topic because people want to find a simple scapegoat or a simple smoking gun that they can point to in order to blame for whatever the problems of our civilization are. I mean, if we talk about obesity, for example, one of the main scapegoats for that has been carbohydrate. And so different hypotheses start cropping up and floating around. Well, the assumption that carbohydrate is the culprit. So once you've already made that assumption, then you can make the leap and say, it's because carbohydrates are addictive. And then you can get even more specific and say, well, it's sugar that's addictive. And this is definitely a controversial topic. It's definitely a hotly investigated topic in the scientific literature. And we don't know all the answers. But what we do know is that it's false to generalize that sugar is addictive. And the problem with assuming that, or the problem with that claim is the assumption that comes from that if you eat sugar, that anybody who eats sugar will eventually become addicted to sugar, and then problems will happen from there. And that's simply not true. There may be a limited subset of individuals who are predisposed to becoming, in quotes, addicted to foods that happen to contain sugar. But even in that case, it's not necessarily sugar per se that's the culprit. It can be the so-called hyper palatability of the foods, which can be a combination of sugar, fat, in some cases sugar, fat, and salt. A lot of the research investigating potential addictiveness of sugar has been done on rodent models. And there are issues there with making the leap of faith that rodent results are extrapolable to humans. But of course, you know, I'm not going to bash rodent research outright. I mean, it's a great starting point for inquiry. And you certainly can control the rodent experiments much more closely than you can control human experiments. But still, it has to be viewed as a hypothesis-generating body of research. The stimulation of the reward centers from things like sugar, even in rodents, has not been adequately compared in a direct head-to-head fashion with what bacon might do to the reward centers as well. So you can't necessarily single out sugar as being some sort of culprit of addiction when you don't compare it to other hyper-palatable or yummy foods. So yeah, a lot of gray areas there. Sugar addiction is, for the vast majority of the population, it's likely a false idea. I mean, if there is any sort of addiction going on, it's something that's behaviorally based rather than neurochemically based or physiologically based. A lot of the food addictive behaviors or binge behaviors, sure, they can have a basis in physiology. However, the common preaching that certain foods are taboo or certain foods are off limits, that sort of idea reinforces binge behaviors, because instead of a person knowing that they can have moderate amounts of whatever they want, what they'll do is they'll sort of place this prohibition label on something like sugar. And what they'll do is they'll have the whole tub of ice cream and then attempt to swear off of ice cream for as many months as they possibly can until the craving returns, you know, and compare that to somebody else who does not have this idea or this sort of conditioned perspective that sugar is bad, sugar is addictive, thus I have to avoid it. And this person can eat sugar daily in moderate amounts and not think anything of it because there's no belief there that this is bad. And so there, therefore, is not the tendency to binge on the stuff with it in the back of his mind that he's going to make a concerted effort to avoid it from here to eternity. So yeah, that's my take on that.
Very cool. We got a really interesting question from Brendan on, I believe this was Facebook too. But he was wondering if you had any like nutrition or supplement recommendations for individuals that live a high stress life. And I think that's like 90% of the people out there who aren't sleeping enough and, you know, are working 60 hours a week and stuck in traffic, the people that are going nuts. Do you have any recommendations to make their lives a little bit easier?
I think that looking to change the diet in order to alleviate a high stress life is sort of the wrong approach. I think you're sort of backing into it, ass backwards, so to speak. I think you need to fix your high stress life and then take it from there. I don't think there's any particular dietary strategy that's going to mitigate that sort of anxiety. If anything, what you could do is just lock into a routine. Lock into a simple routine, a simple dietary routine that does not involve a lot of preparation, doesn't involve a lot of thought. So, but of course, that routine that you lock into has to obviously be reasonably healthy, and it has to be able to sustain or help you get to your goals body composition wise and or sports performance wise. So just my main thing for that would be to lock into a simple routine. Just as an example, you know, you can take somebody's day's eating. If they like to drive through instead of prepare, well, then find your route that you drive through and lock into the menu items that you like most. And then just stick to that. You know, it takes the thinking out of it. Obviously, there are going to be a range of choices on various drive-through menus that you can either turn yourself into Adonis with or turn yourself into Jabba the Hutt with, depending on just how much you get and what choices you make. So make good choices. Get the stuff that still tastes good to you despite the attempt to do, in quotes, healthy stuff. Just lock into the routine. That's what I would advise for minimizing a high stress life. Now, some people can get anxiety from the idea that they may need to eat every 2 hours or every 3 hours in order to stoke the metabolism. But, you know, that's a whole other set of myths that people need to shake themselves free of. And if eating gives people anxiety or breaking out the meals and stuff, then just, you can simply reduce your meal frequency if it doesn't interfere with your goals, performance and or body composition wise.
It'd be a lot easier if McDonald's just had like the Adonis meal and the Jabba the Hutt meal, and you could just pick it that way. It wouldn't even have to, like, now they put the calories and all that stuff up on the menu, and like, you know, you're getting your Big Mac value meal is going to be whatever is like 1300 calories. Well, let's be real. People are dumb when they go to the fast food place. They just don't care. I think we should make it as simple as possible.
I think so, too.
It's like that was the Wall-E thing. It's the whole Wall-E thing, man.
I love that movie. That was a great movie.
That's where we're all heading, hoping everyone has a good seat for that. Man, those people outside are being super loud. All right, so the next question that I'm going to throw to you is in terms of intermittent fasting, just, you know, since you kind of briefly touched on that a second ago, it looks like we'll just use Dan. A bunch of people asked about this, but Dan wanted to know your opinion on intermittent fasting. He says, I've been trying to use it in the context of leaning out while minimizing muscle loss. What do you got?
Sure, he can do that. There's when people say intermittent fasting within the fitness circles, they're usually talking about some sort of variation of within day meal frequency. They're not necessarily talking about the research intermittent fasting where sometimes you got eating every other day type of thing. So intermittent fasting within the context of within day reduction of meal frequency, That's fine for that goal that you mentioned. I mean, the body can pretty easily handle low meal frequency within a day. Now, you start going 1-2 days without eating, obviously, that's going to compromise the retention of lean body mass. I don't see an issue with doing like something from the typical like 4 to 6 meals, bringing it down to 2 to 3 meals. There's really no issue with that. At the same time, this person who asked the question, if he's thinking that there's going to be some sort of extra magic associated with the reduction in meal frequency, whether it's extra fat burning or an increased retention of lean mass as a result of reducing meal frequency, well, then that is not something that's scientifically supportable.
Yeah, and again, I apologize for having to mute myself. They're just like chopping down some friggin' trees outside and then throwing them through a shredder.
That's pretty paleo of you to live in an environment.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of live in the burbs, so it's nice. Sometimes you get the snow is coming off the ground. The landscapers are out now, and since I kind of live around bigger houses with people with money. That's when these guys come out and start chopping all this crap up because people can't get outside to do it themselves.
You're moving up, Kevin. But, and I wanted to mention also about the intermittent fasting thing.
Yeah.
I've held the view for some time now that intermittent fasting it's an option. It's a viable option. But typically, it is a viable option for folks who have weight loss as their main goal. If somebody has aggressive goals of putting on lean mass as quickly as possible, then a reduction in meal frequency can antagonize that goal. So yeah, there's kind of a dichotomy of applicability there with IFing. Yeah, you're certainly not going to optimize the anabolic response by having one or two meals a day. So yeah, just wanted to throw that in there.
Well, let's stay on the subject because we had a question from Jesse asking about if, you know, intermittent fasting could cause digestion problems because you're talking about cramming all those calories, let's just say 2,000 calories for the day into two meals if you're doing the 16-hour fast with the 8-hour feed thing. So I guess Jesse was wondering if this could be a problem. Is there a use for probiotics and digestive enzymes if you're eating one big serving of fruit or vegetables for each meal?
I highly don't think that sort of supplementation is going to alleviate those gastrointestinal effects. What happens a lot, if you can think of what happens after like a Thanksgiving meal, a lot of people are just going to get gassy and they're going to experience some degree of stomach upset, and there might be an increase in the rate of transit through the GI tract to the point where, well, and this gets a little bit off the topic, but hold on, let me get out of Facebook here so we don't get that little noise. Okay. I don't really see any kind of therapies, probiotic wise or other, that would lower the effects of eating meals that are too large for you to comfortably handle in a given sitting. At the same time, I haven't heard much complaints about IFers having those issues. If anything, they really enjoy eating their large meals because most of them are doing it to lose weight. And so those meals are not so large that those symptoms happen anyway. But if they do happen, I doubt you could mitigate it with something like probiotics.
Man, this... Again, I apologize if this is coming through the mic, but they're getting louder and louder. All right, so people, again, we had a bunch of people ask about GMOs. Again, a hot subject because, again, this is one of those things where there can be two sides to this battle where people can be saying, you know, you got to eat organic because, you know, GMOs are going to cause you to have, like, X-Men-like mutations. Man, I wish. What are your thoughts? Do you tell people to stay away from GMOs? Are those going to cause issues? What does the research say?
That's just another one of those concerns that, I mean, the people who are concerned with these things, I call them hippies. And there's nothing wrong with being a hippie, but what characterizes hippies is this sort of naive and childlike idealism. And there's, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with trying to be as healthy as you possibly can be. But there's also everything wrong with ignoring the weight of the scientific evidence. there was a recent systematic review. There's actually a bunch of review articles and a bunch of analyses on the safety of genetically engineered crops and also the nutritional differences between genetically modified animals and whatnot, and like cattle, for example. But as far as the crop thing goes, there is a recent review by Nicolia, and this was in Critical Reviews in Biotechnology, and they looked at the last 10 years of genetically engineered crop safety. And they didn't find any significant hazards with GM foods compared to the non-GM stuff. And this body of literature is controversial, no doubt about it. But the writing on the wall leans towards safety. And you have to also consider that food technology, biotechnology, this stuff is all necessary and it's all life-saving and it all really makes the world turn. We'd have thousands and millions of deaths and disease cases more without food technology, without genetic modification to enhance the production of a wide range of foods. And so the whole GMO scare is really based on unfounded idealism, because when you look at the evidence, you're really going to come up dry in terms of any trend towards showing hazard or any sort of consistent adverse effect or set of adverse effects from GM foods versus not. And so it really is an evidence thing. Some people may point to funding bias, publication bias, etc., but those are things that are going to remain unknowns until the end of time. But as far as the most objective set of evidence that we know of currently, there is no sufficient reason to think that GMOs are, in quotes, bad or hazardous or going to make you grow a third leg, or in your case, Kevin, a fourth leg.
Yeah, that'd be dope. I could run like a horse. Those things are super fast. So this isn't like, again, this is one of those things where, you know, people see there. If you have Netflix, there's multiple documentaries out there, basically telling people that the government and these organizations, Monsanto, all these guys are just in cahoots to poison our food supply and to make money off of our deteriorating health. Not so much the case. Not something that we need to worry about as much as these guys are saying.
Well, that's correct. I mean, we have to go on the objective evidence. Otherwise, we're just kind of going on hunches and hearsay, which collectively is going to get you in more trouble and leave you more ignorant than going on the actual scientific evidence. Scientific evidence is usually of higher quality and greater rigor than what people are dreaming up in their, in their tie-dye labs with the, with all their hippie condiments strung throughout their beaded rooms. I'm in the midst of an email debate with one of my readers. He just bought Girth Control. David Reeder, how are you, buddy? We're going back and forth about organic foods, and there have been a succession of systematic reviews showing that the difference between organic versus conventional foods in terms of both health effects and nutritional quality is negligible. Now, his issue is, but what about the safety? Well, if you are striving for foods with no pesticides, guess what you're going to get? Guess what you're going to increase the risk for? Well, the consumption of the pests. And no antibiotics. Okay, great. And you think about animal care or animal humaneness, if you will. What if our children, or what if humans were not allowed to take antibiotics? What do you think will happen to them? Same goes for the animals. So there's a lot of issues over there with organic versus non-organic, pesticides, no pesticides and whatnot. But once again, the evidence, the weight of the evidence, points to no significant difference in nutritional value or health effects between organic versus non-organic. If you want to do whatever you can to avoid superfluous ingredients or additives or whatnot, then buy the food from your farmers markets or grow it yourself. Otherwise, you know, you go to Whole Foods or go to wherever and buy into the organic stuff. You really don't know what you're getting, and you really don't know how much of it's going to be marketing and skirting loopholes and such. And you're the guy who gets shafted in the end because you're paying double and triple for that. So that's my take on that.
Yeah, just doing some comparison shopping and things like that, you can literally almost break it down to, I think I picked 10 products from Whole Foods a couple weeks ago and just looked at the organic versus non-organic. Organic was like came out to like 41% more expensive.
Like that's lower than what I've seen.
Well, I it might have just been like the 10 products. Like it was Gala apples. It was, peanut butter. It was bananas. It was like things like that. It was just interesting. I was just, because again, you never know how much of this is just a lot of the stuff that we deal with in the fitness industry. It's marketing hype. It's the hype machine that gets people to buy into whatever you're selling. So again, it's why it's good to be as educated about this stuff as you can possibly be these days.
Yeah, and again, you just go to the evidence. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no need to try and squeeze out some intuitive opinion on stuff. Just look at the scientific evidence, and that will tell you where the weight of it is leaning. And there's always going to be conflicting studies, but what you have to do is look at where the evidence is leaning. Given that nothing's going to be 100% in favor of something or 100% against something. So, yeah.
Let's go into another question kind of in the realm of research from Matt. He says, Alan, you really helped me go from using blogs and gurus for my nutrition information to using evidence from clinical interventions. I have a degree in statistics and love putting it to use reading studies. I've read every article of your research review twice and want to plunge deeper. What are a list of the best journals to subscribe to for sports and general information? Or general nutrition, I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, my favorite one for sports nutrition is the Journal of the International Society of Sports Nutrition. And they're a relatively new journal. Their inception date was 2005, I believe. Relatively new journal, but their original aim was to really spearhead sports nutrition. So the cool thing about JISSN, or JISN, as we love to call it.
That's a scientific term, right? That's what you guys use in the circles and the research circles.
Absolutely. Yeah, we love JISN.
Perfect.
The cool thing about it is it's an open access journal. Mm-hmm. And so you don't need a subscription. You just JISSN.com and you're there. You can read their, they have a great set of position papers. They crank out a bunch of really good stuff, and they have amassed a lot of good information in there. So I would highly encourage anybody who doesn't keep up with JISSN to just, keep up with it and get to know their position stands, and also read the new publications as they surface. Another great journal that leans more or actually leans a bit away from the sports side, more towards the clinical side, as the title indicates, is the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. Unfortunately, they are not an open access publication, but their issues are available for free after a year from their publication date. Another good journal that I like is the Journal of Applied Physiology. I also like the Journal of Strength and Conditioning Research. And there's actually a whole list of journals that once in a while will put out some great stuff, and it'll be hit and miss. But for sports nutrition, journals for sports nutrition International Journal of Sports Nutrition and Exercise Metabolism is another good one, but that's not open access. So I would be circling back to JISSN for if you want the good stuff that you don't have to shell out a good amount of dough for.
Let's go to a question from a little bit earlier that I meant to hit on. I passed it, unfortunately. This is from Brian. He said, Alan, food combining, particularly carbs and fats. There seems to be two different camps on this. One that says that you should combine them because the fat slows down the absorption of carbs, or the other one that says if you have a banana with peanut butter, then you're going to gain 10 pounds of fat. Or does it even matter at all? I like that one. I like peanut butter and banana for 10 pounds of instant fat gain.
Well, that's the fallacy of looking at foods or looking at meals in a vacuum, looking at an isolated 2 or 3 hour period from the rest of the day or the week. I mean, it makes no sense. The first one you mentioned about having to eat fat with the carbs to slow everything down, I'm assuming that is referring to the insulin response or trying to prevent a particular insulin response. Well, energy balance by the end of the day, and certainly net energy balance by the end of the week, completely overrides any sort of transient fluctuations in insulin or any attempts to manipulate that on a short-term basis. So, let's see, the second one where you can't eat carbs together with fats because you're going to store the fats because of the insulin response. That's equally as asinine, I would say. So I wouldn't concern myself with those types of things. Now, there are instances where some people are going to engage in rigorous exercise where some people actually don't perform as well and will experience gastrointestinal difficulties if they consume too much fat prior to training. So in that case, you might not want to eat your half a jar of peanut butter with your bananas before you train. But this is all, it all has to be looked at on an individual case basis. And when you try to apply those little food combining or food separation rules to body composition outcomes, it really becomes, they really are non-issues. They just simply don't apply because it's completely ignoring the larger context of what gets consumed in total macronutrition-wise by the end of the day and by the end of the week. That's what matters, not what you do per meal, you know, combining or separating.
Here's another concept that we got a couple of questions on. I think this is from Zoran. I apologize for the name mispronunciation if I did. Alan, you said in one of your interviews that high single-digit body fat is obtainable for basically any male. Is it also possible for every male to maintain high single-digit body fat throughout the year, or do genetics start to play a significant role in this? Of course, it depends on from what level of body fat the person dropped under 10% from, but could you give some basic recommendations for maintaining an above average level of leanness throughout the year? Alberto Nunez said that it's important to achieve that leanness via non-extreme methods in order to maintain it. Your thoughts?
Well, first off, shout out to Alberto Nunez and 3DMJ. Shout out to Eric Helms. Shout out to The Cage. See, I got to get these shout outs out, man. Otherwise, I get lynched online.
No, man, do it. Yeah, so just use the mic. Just scream into the mic. It's like, this is like, to be honest, at the end of the day, like after 300 episodes, I'm just going to start running this like an episode of WWE. So we're just going to have promos at the beginning of every show. I just want to like call up Alan, be like, Alan, all right, here, you got 10 minutes for your promo spot. I just want you to call out some dudes. I want you to talk some shit. And, you know, then we'll kind of like, we'll schedule in like a tag team. We'll do like a tag team match, like maybe a tag team cage match. It'll be like something that hasn't been done before.
And people will just listen to that for hours, just hours and hours of shout outs.
Do you know how Vince McMahon is a billionaire? If he can do it, maybe I can do it.
You know, Kevin, I think you can do anything you put your mind to.
So. Thanks.
Yeah. The whole idea of it being possible for any male to reach high single digits, I would modify that to say that most males can reach high single digits. Saying that everybody can, every male can, that's a little bit bold of a claim, and I'd rather be conservative about stuff. Now, while every or most guys can hit high single digits, sustaining that in the long term, or just having that be your normal year-round body fat level, that's a whole different animal. And only those with favorable genetics can do that. It is entirely true that people run the gamut from having great genetics for leanness all the way to really crap genetics for leanness. And so you take somebody on the crappy end of the spectrum, they may be able to touch that high single digits thing for a very short period of time before needing to bounce back to a higher body fat level. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have the guy who walks around in the single digits all year round. And then, you know, if you put him on some sort of decent diet and training program, he just gets super shredded and vascular and just looking like an anatomy chart. So there has to be a distinction made between being able to reach the high single digits versus sustain the high single digits. And when I say high single digits, you have to keep in mind that elite athletes at the Olympic and the professional levels, the lean ones, range from as low as the sixes to as high as the nine. So six-ish to nine-ish, you're looking at Olympic-level sprinters, boxers, wrestlers. And so you really are not in the high single digits unless you look like a professional boxer, sprinter, wrestler. So people think that they are, but really what most people are hovering around in when they're just normal guy lean is in the low teens. Reaching the single digits is something that only those who are willing to take on a highly athletic regime and maintain that are able to do. And combine that with, you need to have the right genetic propensity to be able to maintain that. I really hate the idea of people making claims that every guy can get a six pack and keep it year round. That's bullshit. And people need to realize that not everybody can get a six pack and not everybody can maintain a six pack. And nor should everybody, every guy be able to do that. It's not necessarily a healthy thing for a lot of people. I soapboxed that a little bit, but yeah. What was the question again?
No, but I mean, like, seriously, how am I going to pick up all these hot biddies down by the beach if I can't get my six pack on? That's why I live in Boston. So I can get lean for like 3 months. But after that, like, you're asking too much of me. I guess the question was, I guess for people out there, is it possible to maintain a, sub 10% body fat for the average person?
No.
Yeah. And this is kind of related to it. The concept of set point, this is from, I think it's Mikael. Or it might be Michael. I'm not sure. It's Mikael. As a follow-up to the question above, and he literally asked us on the same Facebook thing after Zoran. How long does it take to reset one's, quote, set point, if it does indeed exist? For example, someone dieting down from 15 to 20% body fat down to sub 10, or even let's just say 10, just for the sake of argument. They tend to bounce back up because of various reasons like hunger. So what does the evidence say, I guess, in general about the idea of set point? Is this something we should consider?
This is a really good question. And it's interesting because the evidence is really convoluted on this. And you're looking at something that's really difficult to study. There is some research showing that the post-obese still have high circulating levels of hormones and peptides that that would drive hunger, and that would keep their appetite much higher than the normal weight folks. Even after a year of having maintained weight loss. So there can be some hormonal compromises within the post-obese with respect to, in quotes, set point. However, this is not to say that you can't put these folks on a plan that has optimized macronutrition targets, as well as an optimized training program that includes progressive resistance training. So this has not been looked at in the research. But what has been seen in the field is people completely transforming from an obese state to a healthy, reasonably low body fat state, and maintaining that by simple virtue of permanent changes in their lifestyle habits. And while it's true some people may struggle with hunger more than others, I personally think that these changes can occur in, for example, hunger levels over time to a degree that's manageable. I think that set points are more strongly governed by behavioral factors and lifestyle factors and training and diet regimen factors, rather than irreversible physiological factors. So I think that the time frame for somebody to change their, in quote, set point would reflect the time frame it would take for somebody to become consistent with a new set of lifestyle habits. And that's going to be different for everybody. That's going to vary pretty widely. Some people can flip a switch and bam, they're just, you know, they've changed colors. Mm-hmm. Other people will struggle for a number of months or years until they can lock it in. I'd say on average, in order to become a new animal, so to speak, you would need to pound away at a new lifestyle for at least a year. And then you can begin to see changes in terms of the ease of maintaining that new lifestyle and that new body and that new set of habits.
What's wrong with Roger Lawson eating so many cinnamon buns? What's up with that? Like, in your expert opinion, what's up? Like, why does he eat so many of those? Is he trying to control his blood sugar with all that cinnamon intake?
Well, he
must be it.
He's a guy who, I mean, he's a bun man. He loves, yeah, loves him. He loves him his buns.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, he can handle that. He's got enough muscle mass, and you know, he's lifting some heavy ass weights. So I think he can, and plus there may be a little bit of magic there, a little bit of Raj Law magic that nobody knows about. You know, that he will never give away that secret.
Well, I mean, this is my promo for today. You know, I don't know when he's just going to follow his dreams. He obviously wants to work for that company. Like, he should just open up a franchise and just get all fatted up. And then, he's going to be happy if he does that. So, Raj, I know you're listening. If you need like 10 grand or something like that, I got like $1,200. So, you only need like 8,800 if you get me free cinnamon buns. So let's talk about...
It's all in the way he times the Cinnabons. You know, if he eats the Cinnabons within the peri-workout window,
yes,
then it's all good. You know, if he eats the Cinnabons past 6 p.m. Eastern time, then it's all over for him.
But he's in Thailand right now. So what is that?
That's what Thailand is. It's a whole nother level.
Okay. Oh man, it's like a whole different subset of my workout nutrition.
Absolutely, and it's the third kind.
That's when I like stopped giving a crap about like all this junk that you know people were talking about when peri-workout nutrition became the new thing. Like, no man, it's not the pre-workout, it's not the post-workout, it's what you're having during your workout. That's what I mean. Come on, guys.
As if the digestive system doesn't exist. Yeah, you know? Just eat the food and it friggin' just appears instantly in your bloodstream. It's like, come on now.
No, man, it's all about timing. Like, you got to make sure you have something right before, you got to drink something during, and then you got to make sure you drink something after. It's whatever. It's the perfect storm of anabolic, whatever. I don't, man, it's just so weird. All right, so... interesting question from Becky. As a trainer, I hate the word cheat as part of a nutritional plan because it has a negative connotation of restriction attached to it. I prefer to use the word treat. What is your opinion on the word cheat in relation to dieting? And how do you personally deal with clients who have issues of labeling food as good or bad? I guess you touched on this a little bit earlier in the show. But yeah, any other thoughts on that?
Yeah, this is a toughie because you can't look at individual foods as being good or bad and or clean or dirty. And one of my favorite examples of that is ice cream versus celery. So most people would call celery a clean food and they'd call ice cream a dirty food. But if given the hypothetical scenario of only being able to eat one of those foods to survive, you'd survive longer on the ice cream than on the celery. You'd literally last longer before deficiencies and nasty physiological breakdown occurs until you just die. So in that sense, ice cream is much more healthy than celery. But then you pan backward and you look at the diet as a whole, then you see that you can't look at individual foods and judge them on the basis of this within a vacuum in isolation from the rest of the diet. Calling foods cheat foods or treat days or cheat days and things like that. I think that for most people, that's not really a big deal. I use the term junk meals. I use the term indulgence meals. I like the term indulgence, you know, because it doesn't have a negative connotation and it implies that you're having too much of something, and that's okay on a intermittent basis, as long as it doesn't upset the apple cart of health and progressively steer you away from your goals, then that's perfectly fine. I think that it's important to individualize the, in quotes, the cheating strategy. There are certainly foods that you can't predominate your diet with if you want to maintain health. Like, you can't be drinking liters upon liters of Mountain Dew every day and expect that to just fulfill your carb allotment. It's obviously going to lack nutrition. It's going to lack fiber. It's going to lack, you know, a multitude of compounds that benefit health and prevent disease. But certainly if you can fit some Mountain Dew in your diet, I think that, but once again, that stuff has to be individualized. Some people are better at maintaining a daily linear allotment of treat foods. We'll call them indulgence foods. I like to use the 10 to 20% guideline for that. So, that 10 to 20% can be on a daily basis, or it can be distributed on a weekly basis, like in one or two, you know, super hedonistic days, with the other 5 to 6 days being relatively, in quotes, Spartan. Some people work better with the black and white approach that way, while others work better with a daily allotment of indulgence. So there's a lot of gray area associated with the what foods might contribute to disease or not. But it's all context and it's all dose. And as long as the diet is predominated with foods that are whole and minimally refined, then you're really doing everything you can to promote health and longevity. And for those who strive to go zero on the, in quotes, junk food, you're really, from a psychological standpoint and from a life stress standpoint, you're not doing everything you can to prolong longevity and quality of life. So you might as well, if you have foods that you like that are out of the healthy list, then by all means, include them in the diet. But if they happen to be something like Mountain Dew or Coke or just, you know, other crap that you can think of, donuts, then you keep them at roughly 10 to 20-ish percent of the diet. And that 10 to 20-ish percent thing, interestingly, it parallels the World Health Organization's cap they're trying to put on added sugars, which is 10%. The Institute of Medicine puts a 25% cap on added sugars to the diet. And when I'm talking about added sugars, I'm not talking about sugars intrinsic to the food, such as those in fruit and milk. I'm talking about just straight ahead refined added sugars and syrups and those types of foods. So there is a basis, there is a research basis for the 10 to 20% rule, and it does happen to concur with major health organizations, the range of what the major health organizations are putting a cap on as far as added crap, added sugar. So finally, it does reflect what some of the, observationally anyway, some of the healthiest populations on the planet are doing, which is including the fun foods, but in moderate amounts. So that's my take on that.
Very cool. People are just getting a taste of the Alan Aragon experience. So for people out there that want to check out some more of your stuff, I know you have some seminars coming up in a little bit. First and foremost, again, definitely worth mentioning, just because I literally started the podcast the week after the seminar took place in 2006, but the 2014 Fitness Summit is coming up May 2nd and 3rd in Kansas City, Missouri. So I know you're going to be there, but you're also doing another one up in Canada soon, right?
Yeah, that's right. On May 2nd, we'll be doing the Fitness Summit. That's really just a load of fun. There's a lot more partying there than there is sleeping or learning, which is always cool. And I'm going to be talking about my recent research on nutrient timing with my stone cold research bro named Brad Schoenfeld.
Nice.
He's my brother from another mother, as far as the approach to science and evidence and stuff goes. It's really cool. We've got a bunch of good projects in the pipe. We're working on a fasted versus non-fasted cardio study right now. Mm-hmm. And we're also working on a meta-analysis with James Krieger. And we've got some other stuff in the pipeline as well. So a lot of good stuff to hit the pubs with Brad and with James and with other folks. That's going to be on May 2nd, where we discuss the sports nutrition-y stuff, the nutrient timing stuff, which is interesting, Kevin, because a lot of the questions you asked me here on this podcast were all hippie health stuff. And I typically concentrate on the bro stuff, on, you know, getting jacked, losing fat.
And, yeah, man.
You know, flexing in the mirror.
I want to get the pump.
curls for the girls in the squat rack. You know, that's my space. That's my intellectual capacity.
I need to know how much beta alanine I need. How much do I got to take? Take it. Your face is burning off.
Yeah, man. Whatever you're taking now, just triple it when it stops working.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I've been doing my whole life. So I'll just stay with that.
Perfect. You stick with that. You've gone far.
Nice.
After that, I've got a Toronto gig. And this is on June 14th. And this is a biggie because I'm going to be spending from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. just basically dishing out everything I know in terms of theory and application. Mm-hmm. And it will be focused on altering body composition. There is going to be an element of learning research methodology and the nature of acquiring knowledge and sizing up science. But it's definitely going to be focused on the research basis for altering body composition and improving sports performance and pretty much everything in between. It's just going to be a whole day like pounding of knowledge. And this is going to happen June 14th. The website that you can go and get more details about it is move-everywhere.com. And yeah, Toronto, June 14th. Those are the events that are coming up that I wanted to mention.
Perfect. For everything else, you know, where can people stay up to date on what you're doing? You know, I know you're on Facebook and stuff like that and Twitter. Are those kind of the best places, and obviously at your website?
Yeah, I troll Facebook quite a bit. I just got a Twitter account just a little bit ago, man. I only have 100 tweets. And Twitter is a funny thing. You can't really say anything on it with that word limit. It's pretty hilarious.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you want to catch my prime trolling, then you would go on Facebook. If you want to keep up with the research and get into really what I do, then you can go to alanaragon.com and just click on the research review link on the top menu. And then, you know, you can dig through that. My research review, what can I say? I love it. I get a lot of great feedback about it.
How long has that been going on for now? Is it like four or five years?
Six-ish years now.
Okay.
Going on for, yeah, 6 years. And I think it's the reason for all of my gray hairs, but but I've also gotten some muscle maturity, though, since I started it. So it's all good. It balances out.
Great. Man, it's like you never are going to leave school. Because it's like, you know, again, the reason why I like it is just like I used to hate going through all the research in school and just like having to dissect it. And then you got to figure out like, you know, who's funding this research and all that stuff. But yeah, the research review out there for people who are in the industry, definitely check it out. It's well worth the money.
Cool. I appreciate that, Kevin.
But yeah, I think that's where we're going to wrap it up. We're past an hour, which is the amount of attention span that most people have these days. But we'll definitely be talking to you again down the road. And I promise it won't be 3 years again. I think it's like looking at my notes where we're talking before the show. It's been like 2 or 3 years since the last time we had you on. So we'll definitely have to do something a little bit sooner. And who knows? May is not too far away. But it is plenty of time to plan a trip to Kansas City, so maybe I'll see you out there.
Hopefully, man. I'm looking forward to it. Just get, you know, bring your extra liver.
Yeah, no, I just plan on being blackout drunk for 2 days. I usually like to schedule that in, and that way I can do whatever.
Well, I'll bring a couple of my petite female clients, and we'll try to peel you off the floor if necessary.
Perfect. Well, everyone out there, definitely check out Alan's stuff if you need to. I'll have the links for all that stuff in the show notes for the seminars and for his website, Facebook, all that stuff. And as always, if you can, jump on iTunes, submit a review if you haven't already. That's the best way to support the show. And also, you know, check out our sponsor stuff as well. They're kind of keeping the internet tubes, as some of our favorite, I think it was congressmen like to call them, the internet tubes open, and allowing the internet to be sharing my podcast. So Yeah, again, Alan, thank you so much. And thank you, everyone out there, for listening this week.
You got it, Kevin.